Isn't it about time for a change? We are national leaders. AmericanWorkersRadio.com.
You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products, with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio here on 860. As you know, we serve southeastern Pennsylvania, the state of New Jersey, and northern Delaware. If you live in that broadcast range, make sure you go to your telephone, invite family and friends to tune in. If you are not in the range, make sure you let others know that they can tune in and listen live right now by going to the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com. We will send a rebroadcast out this afternoon along with a picture of our panel and our very special guest. As you know, our weekly panel consists of Mark Andel, the founder of the Made in America store, also Larkin Connolly, and by the way, Larkin Connolly is in studio again today. This man likes to travel. As you know, Larkin is a small business advocate and a SCORE mentor. Rich Loges, principal of RJL Technology Integration, is on the broadcast today. And boy, we got a lot of good comments about his special presentation last week. And also, I would like to acknowledge Henry Chaplinsky, our engineer. I'm Michael Blihash, and I am very happy that you tuned in. I ask that you make sure that everybody you know is tuned in today because we have a very, very special guest. First, I want to thank Ted Morton for being our guest last week, the 13th. It's good to see so many efforts to promote the Buy American Made campaign and also the American Made Act, which would, of course, help the people there in Erie County, New York. And Ted Morton is a very, very important part of what is happening there in New York, and we'll be talking more about that. I'll ask Mark to give us an update today during the broadcast. But ladies and gentlemen, today I am honored to have an individual who was our guest back in October of 2016. His name is Mr. Curtis Ellis. He was a senior policy advisor to the then president candidate, Donald Trump. He worked in the Trump administration. He is part of the American Jobs Alliance. He is a producer of many programs and all sorts of press issues. He was on 60 Minutes, Time Magazine, CNN, NBC, the whole gig. And his commentaries appear regularly on TV, radio, and in print and online. And if you haven't met Curtis Ellis or seen him in your travels or reading the paper or on the shows that he's been appearing on, television shows, well, you can certainly be proud to check him out on the internet. He has a number of YouTubes and a lot of things there that he's doing. But I'm first going to reintroduce our panel members to Mr. Ellis, and that is Larkin Connolly, Mark Andel, I'm Michael Blihash, and Rich Loges is here. We're really, really proud that you are joining us again. I'd like to ask Mr. Curtis Ellis to tell us about his activities in the last year, and of course, welcome to the broadcast.
Well, I must say it is great to be back. What a buildup. I hope I can live up to everybody's expectations here. You guys are doing a great job pointing out the importance of buying American and keeping this money and the know-how, the manufacturing ability in this country, in America. We are, you might say, we're only as good as the things we make. We're only as good as how we treat our fellow human beings, our fellow citizens, our family, and our neighbors. And buying from them gives them jobs and keeps everybody, it's a virtuous circle, keeps everybody employed, and it makes our life, the American way of life, possible, as long as people are working and doing things. I have been, I had the great privilege of helping Donald J. Trump become president. I worked on his campaign. I came to his campaign from my previous experience and background promoting America First policies and the American system of economics, which is protecting and promoting domestic industry, investing in the infrastructure so that we can have commerce in this country, and really building up a national economy so that we can participate in a global economy as first among equals, and we take care of our people that way. So from that background, I had the distinct pleasure and privilege of joining the Trump team, getting on the Trump train, and working on trade policy, international trade policy, and the America First, Buy American, Hire American policies that he's espoused. And following his election, which came as a surprise to a lot of people, but not to us, not to, I'm sure, a lot of your listeners, and we know that what he was talking about makes a lot of sense. So we weren't surprised to see that people responded to the call and came out and put him in the White House. Well, after the election, I made the choice to go into the administration and help implement, make those policies and those promises a reality, fulfill the promises and bring the policies to fruition and help Donald Trump succeed and help the administration succeed, which means helping America succeed. So for the last 9 months, last several months, since January, on January 20th, the moment he was sworn in, I was sworn into the Department of Labor, where I worked primarily on the International Labor Affairs Desk, making sure that American workers were not being exploited by the importation of goods made with slave labor. That we weren't competing, that American workers weren't forced to compete against slave labor and child labor overseas. There is a law on the books, the Tariff Act of 1930, that goes all the way back to 1930, that says goods that are made with forced labor, which includes most child labor. Now, it's different if your kid's working on your farm or, you know, working behind a cash register at your store. That's not what we're talking about here by child labor. We mean where, you know what I mean. The law in the book says that goods that are made with forced labor like that cannot be imported, cannot be sold in the United States of America. So we want to make sure those laws are enforced for the first time. They've never been enforced. And also want to make sure that our trade agreements are enforced, and those are some of the issues I was working on, some of the portfolio that I held, and it was very exciting. It was very interesting. I learned a lot about how Washington works. Learned a lot about how the International Labor Organization and the international diplomacy works. So. It was a real privilege to be able to get a firsthand look and see how this government, this huge leviathan in Washington, D.C., operates on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour, and minute-to-minute basis. I continue to be committed to helping Donald Trump's America First policies succeed. There's a thicket of regulations built up over the decades in Washington that are hamstringing American businesses, American workers, American families, that are making it impossible for us to compete and to perform and to be the economic powerhouse, producing the standard of living that people of a certain age are accustomed to. I'm very afraid that young people, and I'll tell you, there's a lot of young people in Washington Most of them, Congress is run by 25-year-olds. They're the staff people that are leading the congressmen around and telling them how to vote as they run to the floor when the bell rings. A lot of these young people, Michael, they did not see the prosperity that we grew up with. They don't understand that there was a time when one person could earn enough to support the family, put a kid through college, and take a vacation a couple weeks a year with the entire family. That's the American standard of living that I grew up with, that I'm accustomed to seeing, and I'm saying, what happened to that? Well, I think my monologue's gone on long enough. I hope I answered your question.
But I want to tell you something, Curtis. Before I go to Larkin, I want to tell you that's exactly what's been missing. People like yourself, people like Larkin, Rich, Mark, and all of the people that are involved in the Buy American Made campaign. I only want to say this. I have never seen a better mood in America from people telling me that they feel there's going to be a successful change in America. They feel that there's going to be more jobs in America. They feel that they will have prosperity under this president because, and mainly one reason, because this president stands up for America first. We discussed this on our broadcast for years. It's the main reason people went out and voted for a businessman as president. So your efforts, his efforts, and all of our efforts are helping make this thing move forward. Next, I'm going to ask Larkin Conley. Dr. Larkin.
Good morning, Michael, and good morning to our audience. Curtis, welcome back to the program. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back. I feel like I've been ungagged, unbound. look forward to talking with you.
Well, there are no gags within 15 miles of the building that we're in right now, and I think you can tell by past programs. It was great to hear you talk about something that most people in this country don't understand, and that is the congressmen and senators come and go. Not as often as I think they should, but they come and go anyway. The one consistent thing that never changes is the staff. The staff on the Hill, I mean, if one congressman loses his or her job, that staff picks up and goes to a different place. But it's always in the same building, always in the same halls. So very few people understand that those kids,
that's right,
and there are a lot of kids involved. Those kids really are running the country.
That's right. It's true. And they're good kids, and they're good people, and they're very smart. Most of these folks graduated first in their class. They're all valedictorians and magna cum laude. Probably a lot of them were a student council president or something, or class president. So they got this. What you end up with, though, I mean, for all the goodness associated with all of this stuff, you get a certain uniformity of mentality.
Yes.
And uniformity of thinking. You don't have a lot of people there who work with their hands, who necessarily, and now, again, the changes in our country, where I don't know how many kids cut lawns during the grass to earn or work at the snack bar at the beach during the summer to earn some money to go through school or to, take their gal out on a date. The lawns are all being cut by immigrants, maybe illegal aliens or working for a landscaping company. And a lot of these lower-level, entry-level jobs are now filled by H-1B or H-2A visa holders,
right,
that come over from Ireland or something to work the summer season at the country club. Long way of saying, a lot of these kids don't have real-world experience. They graduated first in their class. They come right out of university. Their first job's on Capitol Hill in Washington, in the swamp. And there is a certain mentality here that we're going to tell everybody else, we're going to write the rules that the rest of the country's going to follow.
Right.
Well, if you've never actually had real-world experience, how are you going to write rules for the real world?
Yeah, it's so true, and very, very few people understand that. And to that end, the Donald Trump odyssey as president, as I call it, is making headway. It really is. I mean, the man stepped in as a businessman, no political experience, doesn't know, doesn't understand political rhetoric. If it came up and bit him right on the nose, he says what he feels. He says what comes to his mind. And it shocks a lot of people.
It sure does. They don't know how to deal with it. These reporters here say, well, he doesn't sound presidential. Well, who died and made you the determinant, the judge of what's presidential? Just because everybody else is up to now has talked in this gobbledygook Kennedy School of Government, highfalutin way of talking. We got a president now. He's talking. By definition, that's presidential.
Right.
Get over it.
Exactly. And he's saying things that should have been said years ago, that politicians have a way of putting a political wrapping on it, political rhetoric on it, and it makes no sense. I want to divert just a little bit here, away from what we've been talking about, because something happened yesterday that I think is one of many events over the last 4 or 5 months that is finally allowing him to emerge as a leader. And that was his speech at the UN, which I thought was huge and very, very well done. And I think he hit all the points. I read all of the Facebook comments hours before the speech that completely criticized him and said, you know, everybody put your helmets on and run for cover. He's going to talk to, you know, all of this garbage that they came up with. And he turned around, and I'd love to hear your opinion, and really laid a great speech on the UN.
I thought it was a great speech. I thought it was one of his best speeches ever. And it's a breath of fresh air inside the stale halls of Turtle Bay. Missing from that wonderful introduction that I was given, was the fact that I worked at the UN. I was a correspondent, a journalist there covering the United Nations for World Net Daily. And look, the UN, and one of the things that I just loved about President Trump's speech was how he used the word sovereignty and national sovereignty 19 times.
Right.
He made it clear that national sovereignty, what's good for our citizens, is first and foremost in his mind. And he said every country should be that way. Every country must look out for the welfare of its citizens first. And then you have a solid foundation on which to interact with other countries. The United Nations, my experience having been there and seen it close up from the inside, there's, again, a whole bureaucracy there. They've taken it upon themselves to now, they think it's their job to tell everybody in the world what to do and to tell every country in the world what its laws should be, what its rules should be, what its policy should be on everything from energy production to transportation to social welfare. That's not the job of the UN. They're supposed to, they should be looking out, it should be a forum to prevent wars and armed conflict, for countries to sit down and talk to each other rather than bashing each other with a club as the first recourse. But, you know, it's like the servant that decides to take over the house, and they're no longer serving the master, they're bossing the master around, and that's what's happened with the UN. And Donald Trump, again, you know, plain speaking, look, I come here as the president of the United States. I do not seek to be president of the world. I am serving. I'm going to look out for what's good for our people, and everybody else do that, and then we'll all get along just fine.
And what's wrong with that message?
He said
Trump has said all along, and nobody has heard it because they hear NATO. They hear Paris Climate Accord. And all Trump has said was not that he didn't believe in the Paris Accord. He said, I'm going to give you 20 trillion reasons why we're not going to fund 80% of this movement. Right. I'm going to give you 20 trillion reasons why we're not going to pay for NATO and be the only one that contributes. Everybody's going to carry their load. This man is representing this country. And I don't get it. He's not an oratorical genius, no question about that. But I can't find a whole lot to disagree with that comes out of his mouth. Everybody wants to pick on the other stuff.
Curtis, I thought yesterday that the news media went out of their mind because they couldn't find much wrong with the speech.
Right.
They tried every which way, but nothing, absolutely nothing worked. Mark Andel, I know you're there ready to welcome our special guest, Curtis Ellis. Mark, how are you?
Great, great. How you doing, Mike, Clark, and Rich, Henry, and listeners? Curtis, great to have you back on. Breath of fresh air to hear you speak. Just everything you're talking about is just reality. And, you know, I'll say, Curtis, you've been to Buffalo. You've been up to my stores. Our flagship store, I'm honored to have 36 buses in these 3 weeks, so I guess we're making a difference, too. And they come from Kansas, Wichita, Kansas, Michigan, San Diego. But what you're talking about, your common sense approach and what you're talking about is what I'm hearing. I just had a bus from Iowa yesterday in Wichita, Kansas, 96 people, two buses. And, you know, most of them had blue jeans on. Most of them had a tough handshake. And none of them had the earrings and the tattoos. And I noticed this because I noticed they're Americans, you know. And every one of them circles, some cry, combat veterans, and a lot of them are farmers. And, you know, the farmer was the first original business. The farmer, you know, a lot of talks with these gentlemen. They farmed, then they worked, and they put themselves through college. When you talk about these 25-year-olds in Washington, and, you know, they can be first of their class, but if they don't have common sense, drive, or ambition, or have done something in their life to get the experience they need to be in that position, there's a problem. And talking to farmers lately from Iowa and Wichita, Kansas, a breadbasket of America, I'm hearing what you're talking about. Them are the people. The demographic I get in on the buses is 50 years old to 97, was my oldest over the weekend. They are, you know, the one I just met, farmer, Marine, he flew in on his plane and he started AmeriCraft, waterless cooking. But just to talk to him and his energy at 68 years old. And our president, I'll say this, people ask me, Mark, what do you think? And I always say with the Made in America store or my General Welding, I stay non-political. It's not an R thing, a D thing. It's an American thing. And I'll say this about Mr. Donald Trump. I said, I have my military work back. I have oil and mining back. He stopped the TPP Act, and he's investigating the Dodd-Frank Act, which is hurting our businesses from getting money. He's an entrepreneur. He's 72 years old. He took the largest job in the world. He must have did it because he loved America. So that's my, you know, I thank you for what you're doing. It's unbelievable. We're making a difference in a small town of Elma here. We're rocking and rolling with 7 stores and 7,000 products.
That's
and I tell
great.
Everybody, isn't it amazing? I have 7,000 products, support 500 privately owned American businesses, non-publicly traded, but we don't have one item that plugs in the United States of America or takes a battery. I said, we've been to the moon, but we can't build a toaster. And I said, that's a problem.
It sure is. You know, Mark, thank you for what you're doing. I remember when you opened that store, when you had one store and you opened it, when you opened your first store, and you're just doing a tremendous job. You hit on something there. It is a shame that you can't find an American-made electronic item.
Not one.
They used to make Zenith television sets in Batavia, New York.
Yeah.
They used to make the picture tubes. Now, you know, for... Somebody can say, what's a picture tube? Well, we'll save that for another show. But the decision was made to give the electronics industry to Japan. The decision was made to give the textile industry to Latin America or to South Asia. The decision was made, these decisions, by the way, were made in Washington. They weren't made anywhere else. They weren't made in a boardroom. They weren't even made, we're going back a half century or more now, they weren't even made in Wall Street. These were decisions that were made at the State Department. And in Washington, the geniuses there, the geopolitical geniuses said, we need to build up the middle class in countries around the world in order to stop the spread of communism. Let's make these countries have a middle class, wealthy. And the way we're going to do that is by giving them our industries and letting them have tariff-free, tax-free entry to sell their goods in our market, even as those countries erect trade barriers so we can't sell our goods in those countries. That will make those countries wealthier, create a middle class, and that will stabilize the world and stop the spread of communism. Well, it worked well. It worked really well. But what they didn't count on is it impoverished vast areas of our country. It's now time to rebalance the formula, rebalance our trade agreements so that we put Americans first rather than the Bangladeshis, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Mexicans, the Colombians, the Hondurans, and everybody else on earth that we were so terrified would become Flora the Red Menace or something.
Yep.
So that's what happened. And, you know, Senator Fritz Hollings, former Senator Fritz Hollings from South Carolina, wrote about this back in 1960 when he was welcoming John Kennedy into the White House. He sent a letter to President-elect Jack Kennedy, and he said, "Our people in South Carolina who work in the textile industry have sacrificed enough of their jobs to help stabilize the world so that the people in the State Department can play their geopolitical games. It's time to think about what's good for Americans. And if you're going to be giving away jobs and industries to some other part of the world, give away somebody else's jobs, not the South Carolina people." You know, and there is just so much of the government that is on autopilot. I saw it. I saw it firsthand every day, every hour. There are regulations on the books that are the result of executive orders that were written 40, 50 years ago. And we're spending billions of dollars on these things, on these programs and policies that don't make any sense. You know, I just found one little example that has some real-world effect right there in Pennsylvania. And let me just back up for 1 second. What happens a lot is there's an overall approach in Washington that we're going to regulate industries. We're going to write regulations, one size fits all, and it's going to make our air cleaner. It's going to make, you know, our soil richer. It's going to do this. It's going to do that. And what they end up doing is they end up writing these regulations in concert with the big guys, with the global corporations. And it leaves out, and the global corporations have the resources and the money to comply with the regulations, but they craft the regulations in a way that at the same time they may deliver cleaner air, cleaner water, you know, more hair on the top of my head, they also drive out the competition. So the smaller competitors, the small business, the independent businessman can't afford to comply with the regulations and are forced out of business, which then means more market share for the big guys. An example here is with oil refineries, the clean fuel standard, ethanol, right? So back 10, 15 years ago, government wrote a rule, said ethanol has to be added to every gallon of gasoline. It's going to be cleaner air. And so it burns cleaner, and it's for the purpose of clean air. Okay, good. So what do? They created a system where for every gallon of ethanol that's added to gasoline, the refineries get a credit, or the blenders, because there's a whole industry of gasoline blenders that just add ethanol. That's all they do. They don't refine oil into gasoline. They just add the ethanol. Every time they do that, they get a credit. They get more credits than they need, so they sell them. They sell them to the refineries, or they sell them to somebody else who then can say, I met the requirement, I did what I was supposed to do, and leave me alone, Washington, I complied. Well, here's where it gets tricky. The way the EPA wrote the rule, only the refiners are required to comply with this rule of, you know, adding the ethanol. And so the folks that actually add and blend the gasoline, they produce these paper credits, but it's the small independent refiner that is required to buy the credits, that says they blended the fuel, even though they're not blending the ethanol. It's a little complicated here, but the net effect is the global oil corporations and the gasoline blenders, which, by the way, happen to be owned by Wall Street trading companies like Goldman Sachs-type outfits. J.P. Morgan owns the biggest blending operation on the planet. They're trading these credits, forcing the small independent refiners, a couple of them are down there in the Delaware Valley, to buy them. And these guys are spending hundreds of millions of dollars just to comply with a rule that was written to help the big guys. It's forcing them out of business. It's forcing them to lay off workers. And it's forcing up gasoline prices. See, you have this attitude in Washington. Well, we wrote a rule. Is everybody following the rule? Are they following the rule? Great. Nobody stops to ask, is the rule accomplishing a good? Is the rule working? No, it's just, are people following the rules? It's a very pernicious system, and the worst part of it is you've got the big global corporations working with big government, and it's hurting the little guy. And it seems to me it's happening too often in too many situations, in too many instances for this to be an accident. It seems like we have seen this movie too many times, and it is conveniently helping the big guys and stomping out the little guy. And that's the one of the worst things about how business is done in Washington.
And, you know, Curtis, I think that the only way we can really straighten that out is to eliminate the fourth branch of government. I think we all know that there's the executive branch and that there's the judicial branch and there's the legislative branch. But that fourth and very important and very active fourth leg of the government really needs to be eliminated. And that's the lobbyists.
The lobbyists and the bureaucrats, the regulators. There's just vast bureaucracies in the Labor Department. There's 17,000 people working in the Labor Department. Most of them are in, you know, one building there, right, a couple of blocks from the Capitol. These people sit out all day churning out regulations, writing rules, and that's the thing that President Trump, Donald Trump, talked about it on the campaign trail. The executive order, right? Obama did so much with the pen and the phone. He didn't even have to pass a law. Congress did not even have to pass a law for new regulations to just come out of thin air. He could just issue an executive order. One I uncovered. President Clinton signed an executive order directing every agency to come up with a plan to promote environmental justice. Well, what the heck is environmental justice? Environmental justice is if you live in a poor neighborhood, or let's put it this way, environmental justice is this. It's a buzzword meaning there's more likely to be a junkyard in the poor neighborhood than in Beverly Hills. Right, the garbage dump is going to be closer to Tobacco Road than it's going to be to Beverly Hills. Okay, that's environmental justice.
They're not They're not building prisons in Shaker Heights, Ohio. We know that.
Right. Exactly. So,
but you know, Curtis, I want to ask you something. Who imposed this particular new idea on the oil company?
This goes back to the EPA did, the Environmental Protection Agency. It goes back to 2005. It's a very, the idea of trading these credits, it's kind of like the cap and trade scheme that that Obama tried to do. By the way, the whole cap and trade idea and this whole thing of we're going to create a paper credit that then can then be traded and banked, that was dreamed up on Wall Street. It gives them something else to trade. So they're now trading these credits. It started out 2005, then it was expanded in 2007. And it's taken on a life of its own. And the big banks and Wall Street got involved. And they found, hey, here's something else we can trade. We've got, they bought an equity stake in a company, Montane Blenders. and they're producing billions of these paper credits and more than they can use. So they sell them to that outfit there in Pennsylvania that refines jet fuel for Delta Airlines. And because Delta is, and it's interesting that only the small refiners, the independent guys, they're the only ones that are required to be reporting and buying these credits, the captive market.
Curtis, I know exactly where you're talking about, the one in Marcus Hook. They're going through all this nonsense over there.
Exactly. And everybody agrees it's a rigged system and it should change.
I want to now call upon our very distinguished man, a man who could tell you everything and more, the very well-known Rich Loges. Welcome our special guest.
Good morning, guys, and Curtis, thank you so much for being here. Does Michael have a way with introductions or what? I have to say, distinguished.
Postmaster General.
Ooh, I'm looking over my shoulder right now. Who is he talking about over here? Distinguished. You know, Curtis, I want to first, I've got a lot of notes here, so I want to get back to you speaking as our special guest here.
Sure.
So aside from thanking you, I want to just ask a favor on air, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Curtis, whatever access you may have to the national GOP leadership, can you please ask them, the GOP, to stop pretending that they don't know why Donald Trump was elected president? Can we please stop pretending? Can Paul Ryan please stop pretending and Mitch McConnell why Donald Trump was elected the president? You know, I have to tell you something. I want to congratulate you, Curtis, for getting a story written about you in the Daily Beast back in May. You know what I'm referring to? They had that photo of you with the dollar signs over your eyes.
Yeah.
Now look, I don't want to get into a Daily Beast thing. The Daily Beast is another colluder in what I call the D-Mike, the Democrat Media Industrial Complex. The Daily Beast is run by a company called Interactive Corporation, and one of their board members of IAC happens to be, drumroll, Chelsea Clinton. So I want to thank you for that, because whenever I see a D-Mike story speaking badly about someone in the Donald Trump circle, I know that it means you're probably doing something right. You talked about a movie. I want to pitch a remake of Nightmare on Elm Street to you, Curtis, called Nightmare on K Street, because I am convinced that President Trump and people like Steve Bannon must terrorize the D-Mike, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Democrats in their dreams. I think we should make a movie. I'm convinced of it. You guys are like the new Freddy Krueger of politics.
Well, you know, I walk around with a hockey mask.
You guys must, like Steve Bannon.
You're the bejesus.
I mean, I got to tell you, I am envious of this guy, not in a bad way. But the fact that the Democrat media industrial complex speaks so much, I mean, they're obsessed the way they used to be obsessed about Fox News. But Fox News has been losing viewership. They're, you know, their relevance has kind of gone down a little bit over the years. But still, they're the only non-Democrat network, so that's why they've still got, right, the amount of viewership that they have. So if I can just ask you to please go to the GOP leadership and have them stop pretending, because if the D-Mike had actually done their job during the election, they would have gone out and asked Trump supporters, black, white, man, woman, Chinese, Christian, and atheist, and asked those Trump supporters, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Trump supporter, don't you think this candidacy is a rebellion against the two-party industrial complex, against the government regulation industrial complex, and against the America Second industrial complex? And what the D-Mike would have found was, yes, people did believe that. But instead, they didn't do that, Curtis. They went out to the rallies, and they went out and they disparaged the people there. They talked about their education level. Well, guess what? The joke was on them.
Yep. Rich, you are so smart. And you know, the thing that astounds me is it's so clear. It's so clear to you. It's so clear to me. It's so clear to so many your listeners, to so many thousands, 63 million people voted for Donald Trump. Why is it so difficult for what you call the D-mites to understand? I'll address a couple of things here, but first, let me start with this one. Why is it so difficult for them to understand? If these reporters, look, they're entitled to their opinion. They don't like Donald Trump. They all wanted Hillary Clinton to be president, or Bernie Sanders, or whoever the Green Party candidate was, whatever they want. That's fine. But just do your job. Like you said, go out and ask people, why did you vote for him? Why do you like this guy? What is it that he's saying that resonates with you? Why are you going to the barricades to fight alongside this man? Just do your job. Ask the questions. Report what's going on. And keep your opinions to yourself. Instead, they want to tell the rest of us what we should think. They want to tell us what Donald Trump really means when he says America first. They want to tell us when Donald Trump says make America great again, he really means something else. No, that's not your job. They have taken it upon themselves that they are the gatekeepers of what is acceptable opinion, what is acceptable information, what is an acceptable candidate. That's not their job. Their job is to report what's happening in the world around them. Tell the rest of us what they see. They are the eyes and ears, and they're supposed to use their mouth and their pen to tell us what they saw and heard, period. End of story.
Amen.
They don't want to
Curtis,
do that.
Amen.
Yep.
Now,
amen is right.
GOP leadership, let me just say one thing. Remember this. After Mitt Romney lost in 2012, the GOP spent a fortune doing an autopsy to figure out why they lost. They never did a similar report to find out why Donald Trump won in 2016.
Curtis, I've pitched this on the air before, and I'm going to say it again. I want a constitutional amendment to require a lie detector test of every Republican congressman and woman to determine who voted for Hillary Clinton on Election Day. I want to know. I want to know. America wants to know. I tell you something. I wish that I could have been look, I don't mean to pick on Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, but, they're the main leadership in the GOP right now nationally. And, my God, I wish I could have been a fly on the wall the day after Election Day, because I guarantee you, just like the Dems, they woke up and said,
oh, my God,
what in the world just happened last night?
Well, they haven't woken up yet.
It's just amazing that the Democrats, I actually had a Democratic friend, I wish I could say friend, it's actually a family member, tell me a couple days ago that 95% of the people that voted for Donald Trump can't read.
Oh, interesting.
Can't read.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where he heard that.
It was a he, she. I mean, I was being double teamed.
But also, where did the respect for being president of the United States go to? If you've got to face the win or loss and then accept, and we've got to get respect back in Washington and trust. And
remember when they had that whole hue and cry in one of the debates, the final question to both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton was, will you accept the outcome of the election? And Hillary Clinton said, yes, I will, yes. And Donald Trump says, we'll see, right?
Yeah, right.
Basically saying if the election has been rigged, yeah, but we'll wait and see. And everybody was like, oh, my God, this is the death of democracy. This is horrible. The orderly transition and transfer of power, that's sacrosanct. Hillary Clinton is not accepting the outcome of the election. The entire media is not accepting the outcome of the election. Vast swaths of both parties are trying to nullify the outcome of the election. That's what they're trying to do. That's what's going on here in Washington. And
Curtis, it's strange, but if the media was wise, they would say, let's everybody get together and work together to see if we can finally get all the jobs that we possibly can back.
That's
for our
right.
working age, able-bodied family, friends, neighbors, enemies, friends. But they're not doing that. They're looking to go back before the election and at election night and just rehash and find every idiotic way to waste our time. And that's what they're doing. They are wasting America's time. And
Micah, can I make a point?
Yes.
Can I make a point on that? Because I, as a former journalist, Curtis, and I wasn't covering national elections. I worked as a journalist for 4 years. Never once consciously did I seek to interject my opinion. Of course I had an opinion. Of course journalists are flawed. Of course we have our biases. But what we saw in the election was not bias. We saw collusion at the level that and I'm sorry for the extreme example, but it's just the only one that comes to mind. If the founders of the Pravda and Joseph Goebbels were in America now, they would look at the Democrat media industrial complex and ask themselves and wonder aloud, how did you guys do it? How did you take free and open press, not run by the state, capital S, by the state, and convince tens of millions of people into believing anything we want them to believe? And I will say this about the campaign as a whole and now the administration. And I'm not saying this, Curtis, to be a sycophant toward you guys and just give these empty compliments and platitudes. I will tell you the number one thing that I think I respect most about the candidacy and everyone there. Whenever the Democrats and the D-Mike punched, you guys punched 10 times back.
Right.
You guys, right? The D-Mikes, I can imagine in the staff meetings when someone came in and said, you know, Mr. Trump, the Washington Post today said you're a sociopathic serial killer who looks like Jeffrey Dahmer. Oh, yeah? Two rallies in Ohio. And this is a point that I made last week about winning the states. Because the president may not have won Cleveland, but he won Ohio. He might not have won Miami. He won Florida. He may not have won Philadelphia, but he won Pennsylvania. He may not have won Detroit, but he won Michigan. He may not have won Madison, but he won Wisconsin. He may not have won Chapel Hill, but he won North Carolina. So every time it happened, you guys fought back. And you see that right there. Can we please let the GOP know the winning game plan is directly in front of our faces? I mean, imagine being a sports team and knowing every play the next team is going to call. As the Patriots, they know about that. But imagine knowing the next call that the team is going to run. Would you not win like every game? The GOP has the winning strat. My God, it's there, and the Dems are gone. They're gone. They're beyond repair. They're beyond salvation. But the GOP's got to understand one fact, though, Curtis, in my opinion, with all due respect to them. They're not really getting elected because they're really loved. They're kind of getting elected because the Dems are so bad, and it's the lesser two evil thing, and we can do better than that. And the GOP has got the winning formula. But they're still, it seems to me, in denial over it.
I have to agree with you. There's a lot of confusion in this town. There's a lot of, look, Donald Trump ran against the establishment in both parties, and that has left a lot of people in shock. The Democrats are still thinking, well, we've got to resist, we've got to persist, we've got to insist, we've got to whatever. They don't realize, well, excuse me, Donald Trump talks about getting out of NAFTA, fixing the trade deals to help the American workers. I thought the Democrats were supposed to be the pro-worker party. They've lost their way. They should be finding ways to work with President Trump on infrastructure, on rebuilding our highways, our ports, our airports, on fixing the trade deals or getting rid of them altogether. On raising the wages of working Americans. There's plenty they can work on. Instead, they're in this knee-jerk reaction of he's Hitler, he's worse than Hitler, or whatever. They pretend they're the French Resistance. I don't know what they think they are, but it's ridiculous. And the Republicans, a good number of the Republicans, I don't have to name the names because you know who they are, they're in shock. They're still in shock. Well, and they probably think, well, Donald Trump won because Hillary Clinton was bad. No. What did he say that got people to vote, people who you didn't even know existed? Now, I've heard that one of the big data mining specialists for the GOP admits, we don't know who the Trump voter is. We didn't know these people existed. Where did they come from?
Right.
folks, you need to get out more. That's all I could tell you.
You know what, Curtis? Americans have been living in a false economy for so long.
That's right.
Where the government became almost your father, your mother, your sister, your brother, your helper. And that's not what America was built upon, I'm sorry to say. And I see, even in working in human services, I see that so many of these people in these departments want to keep people in poverty because they keep their jobs. They could care less about the people. They say, poverty is will be with us forever. The poor will be with us forever. But also getting the poor into jobs and job skills is something that we should forever be trying to accomplish.
I've never seen a socioeconomic problem in this country, in this world, or in the history of this country, of this world, that can't be solved by a job.
You know,
that's
Larkin,
right.
You're right. And you know, Curtis and Mark and Rich, take a look at what happened to other countries as people became employed. They enjoyed taking our jobs, doing a great job, and going up the ladder as jobs left America, left us with what we have today. We have huge millions of people out of a job. And why? Who's been paying attention? I had a big argument the other day with somebody about infrastructure. They said to me, well, the infrastructure is so poor. I said, well, it was poor for 30 years. What did the politicians do about it? And he says, well, how about the people? I said, the taxpayers don't control what is fixed or not fixed in America with the tax dollars.
And Mike, could I bring up the Made in America Act?
Yes, I was ready to call you.
Well, Curtis, you know, a few weeks back, probably 3 weeks now, Erie County legislator Ted Morton suggested we have a new law, and that law requires the local law requires that $1.3 billion that's spent in Erie County is first sourced made in America, and because it makes sense. So, you know, 3-4 weeks ago, they called a hearing. 9 out of 10 legislators, one was 6, so there was an 11. 9 out of 10 legislators said, yes, that makes sense. Then it came down to a public hearing. I went down with my wife, and only one person, they tried to slide it under the rug. We showed up. I told them about the movie and my story and what we do and try to support Ted and this common sense law that I ask most people about, and they agree that it shouldn't have to be a law. This is common sense. Always first source local. And then last Friday, unfortunately, Mark Poloncarz, our county executive, vetoed it. Basically, you know, he put out there was some information basically that it wasn't in the correct form. But here's a great law that makes common sense. Basically, just says source first local, first buy your steel here, first use your local iron workers, and that should be common sense in America.
Right.
So Ted Morton's got to go back at it now, and I just want your opinion on that. But I got a taste. I stay on the grassroots side because I can get more done.
Exactly.
So
I think it's a great
what's your
idea.
Point, your thought?
I think it's a great, great, great piece of legislation, a great policy that should be adopted, not just in Erie County, definitely in Erie County, and in every county in America, and by the state government, and by the federal government. I'd like to see Andrew Cuomo sign a similar thing for the billions of dollars New York State spent. Now, I'll tell you, we're trying to do something like that at the federal level. There's an added wrinkle in that in a lot of these trade deals that we've written, that we've signed, there's a clause in there that says, let's just say, for example, Korea, that steel made in Korea has got to be treated as if it were trade in, made in America. Right, it's called national treatment. You have to accord national treatment to the goods made in your trading partner's country. So we've got to fix that too. But
who put that in effect, Curtis? Who put that in effect?
That started going back in the Clinton years, and it's part of the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization. I mean, there's a devil's bargain if ever there were one. China. Signed into the World Trade Organization, doesn't obey any of the rules, yet the bedwetters in Washington feel like, oh, we got to obey the World Trade Organization rules, otherwise we're going to have a trade war. Well, I'll tell you what, folks, we had a trade war already, and we're losing.
Curtis, I don't know if you heard of a wigwam sock, but it's out of Sheboygan,
sure.
Wisconsin. And, you know, Bob Chesbro is a third-generation owner. When I first met Bob, you'd love him because he was so against the TPP Act. You know, that would have put out every last private industry I deal with, the 486 of them. But, you know, he lost his textile industry to these government deals that you're talking about. And he said, this was my generation, my family, my 300 employees' business. They gave it all away. He said he's an outlaw in this country at any show he goes to. And he produces the best sock in the country, if not world.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We have an ad for Wigwam Socks on the American Jobs Alliance homepage. Yeah,
oh,
he's
beautiful.
A great American. He's
great
man.
Family. Great family.
You know, this. You're trying to pass something in Erie County. Let me say, that's where my journey started, working with Jack Davis, a great factory owner, produces silicon carbide heating elements used to make the Gorilla Glass that shows up in the iPhones. He's Corning is one of his biggest customers. And anyway, Jack's down there in Erie County in Akron, New York. Back in 2003, he was fighting the free trade area of the Americas. And that was the latest trade deal being pushed by the Bush administration. And he got the Niagara County, he introduced resolutions similar to yours at the Niagara County Legislature and the Erie County Legislature and the Boston City Council resolutions opposing this. You know, calling on Washington to reject the free trade area of America. So I'm with you, Mark. The grassroots level, very effective. We've got to make sure our voices are heard there. Because those are the people. I remember when Mark Poloncarz first ran for county treasurer. He was a nobody and got elected. And now he's county executive. One day he's going to probably take Brian Higgins' place and hopes to go to Washington. And you never know. These are the future leaders of tomorrow.
Curtis, when are we going to be able to continue this conversation with you? I hope very, very soon.
Very soon. You just asked me, and as long as I'm not shacked up with some bathing beauty somewhere, I'm all yours.
Curtis, thank you for tuning in. We'll get a rebroadcast of today's show out on the internet in about 2 hours. I want to thank Larkin Connolly in studio, Mark Andel, Rich Loges, Henry Chaplinsky. I'm Michael Blihash. Thank you for tuning in until this Saturday at 11 a.m. or next Wednesday at 11. I want to thank you for going out and supporting American Made. Speak up, ask up for all American Made, and make sure the people behind the counter know you're a supporter of American workers and the American Made campaign. Have a great one.
Thank you, Curtis. It's great to have you on.
Thank you.
Thanks,
great
Curtis.
To be here. Keep up the good work.